Hi and hello and welcome to the RBR.music podcast. My name is Steve Curley and as always I'm joined by the creator of the RBR.music Instagram page, Jordan Murray. Hello.
Hello.
Where in each episode, in true RBR fashion, we normally bring you classic or new album reviews. However, we've gone off-road today and we're actually going to be reviewing a music doco. Isn't that right, George?
Is it? That's new. Hold on, I thought we were going to review that album.
No, you're wrong. Oh. No, you're wrong. We're breaking the mold today.
Okay.
We're actually going to be reviewing...
Just let me get my notes.
A... the notes you've not made.
No, this is all
We are actually going to be reviewing Croc of Gold, A Few Rounds with Shane McGowan. Music documentary released in 2020, recommended by Jordan. Was this a recommendation from someone from Instagram, Jordan?
I could lie but and say yes, it was. But no, I have had some recommendations for documentaries, which I've taken on board and we'll hopefully review in the future. But I saw this on a streaming service and put it on. And the opening of it, I just thought, this is going to be fun. So I told you to, or I asked you to watch it. And here we are, sat in front of microphones discussing
you,
it.
You did indeed. And of course, it would only be customary to say, it is our mission to cut through noise to discuss the sound and vision today.
Sound so, and vision. There you go. David Bowie. Was that planned?
No, I went with it.
Good. Sound and vision.
Well, you know, I do what I do. Yeah. But yes, we're going to...
Pat on your back. We're just going to praise ourselves. you know, blow our own trumpets. Thanks for listening, guys.
And goodbye.
Yeah.
We're going to have a very light conversation about this documentary. We want to impress a few things that we discovered, learnt and enjoyed, and not enjoyed, possibly. Spoiler alert. And hopefully this is the start of something a little bit extra along with our usual podcasting. So take it away, Jod Murray.
Okay, so here we are. There's a lot of interest in here, even if many of the anecdotes are well-worn. McGowan's early years in Tipperary, his school days in Tunbridge Wells and the Barbican in London, and his formative time in the late 70s punk circuit. It's an hour in before we even get to the Pogues, none of whose members are interviewed here. Instead, it's his sister, Siobhan, and father, Maurice, who make the most telling contributions. The former is no-nonsense and directs, telling of her awe when she first heard audiences chanting her brother's name and her decision to commit him to a psychiatric clinic in the late 80s. McGowan Sr., on the other hand, sniffs with entertainingly Celtic disgust over his teenage son's interest in the Anglo-American rock band Creedence Clearwater Revival. Julian Temple, the director, with his long experience of filming punk rock types, is probably the only director who could have made this film work. McGowan clearly doesn't want to be interviewed and is not really in optimal physical shape to be interviewed. Instead, Temple assembles an artful collage of snippets and recordings and raids the archive footage with his trademark hand-drawn animation in what probably seems like a smart tactic. Temple also has a bunch of McGowan's friends, including Johnny Depp, who is one of the film's producers, Bobby Gillespie from Primal Scream, and Gerry Adams from Irish Politics, to try and draw McGowan out. but these sessions really don't add a great deal. It's like listening to barflies arguing about spur change. In the end, the film operates best as an act of ancestor worship to an extraordinary musician whose best days, we are forced to sadly conclude, appear to be behind him. Death stalks the film, and not just because McGowan has defied the odds after years of drug and alcohol abuse. Early on, he reveals his preoccupation with the ghosts of his dead relatives, which prompted his return to be a Catholic, as well the victims of the Irish famine, whose bones he says he accidentally unearthed on a beach in Mayo, resulting in the song The Dunes, which he gave to a singer called Ronnie Drew to record. For all that, McGowan is still a life force to be reckoned with. Here we are, a crock of gold. So I've always... Is that a play on words? Because I've always, since I was a young kid, I've always heard, like, adult... Well, I'm an adult now, but when I was a young kid, adults would say a crock of shit. They would, though. So is crock of gold the actual proper term? Or is that a play on words?
I mean, yeah.
Just throw you in the deep
end. No, I've heard the term crock of shit, and obviously fully aware that, it is a bit of a slang. I think, just having a quick look now, a personal thing that is old, decrepit, or broken down slang. Crock.
Right.
So I guess, yeah, possibly. Foolish, wrong, or untrue. So maybe it is a playful kind of take on the term crock, crock of shit, crock of gold. Well, I don't want to get too far ahead of our discussion, but, like, I think at the end of the film, and after maybe a little bit of the discussion, it sort of makes sense, a crock of gold, because...
Yeah, it's worn out, it's broken, but is... If you listen to him, he's an educated, clever, witty person. And that there's your goal.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of an indication to an element of the playfulness that this film has.
Yeah. I got taken really straight away with the documentary when I think I texted you pretty much as soon as these words hit my ears. I can't remember word for word what was said, but something like Shane McGowan was saying, I was put on this earth to give the world Irish music. God gave me the right to give the... God chose me to give the world Irish music. And then a woman off camera says, why would God do that? And he spits out, because God's Irish! And I thought, yeah. Why not? This is going to be a fun ride. And it was, to an extent. There's listening to his little witticisms and things, and the poets that he admired, and the punk scene. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I was going to say, just to put it in some context, just because, again, we're playing with this one for the listeners. We've never sort of done this sort of discussion publicly before, and one thing that we kind of want to get is people to watch this documentary and then have a discussion among themselves or back with us. I suppose if we start at the beginning of the film, and it starts off with a very blunt opening of Shane McGowan being sort of clearly asked questions in and around the sort of production of filming. And I think there's a request for some music to be played in the background. And I think one of the crew says, oh yeah, we'll put it in afterwards, as if to say it's post-production, kind of like, musical and vocal audio.
No, I think he actually think he wanted to listen to it. He just wanted to listen to it.
Yeah,
It was nothing to do with...
Okay. Because I got...
The post. He just wanted to listen to it while he was speaking, and they said, we'll listen to it once we've finished filming.
Yes, that's what I mean. You've taken it as he just wanted to listen to it. I took it as maybe he wanted it as part of the artistic telling of the story. I mean, either way, he sort of told no, and he very, very quickly and inadvertently sort of pushes back and says, well, you won't get another word out of me, or you won't get another fucking word out of me. And straight away, it's a bit like the opening of any film. It's like, right, this is the narrative that's going to sort of be led, and you can see that. And I imagine most people who do watch this film will have a good understanding of Shane already, because it is quite a fan's film, but I do think there's a lot more to it. I think you can not be a massive fan and enjoy this as a piece of art. But it starts with his Irish life, and as George said, it takes about half an hour of his Irish history, really, doesn't it, George? Before you kind of hit the punk Shane, really. It's sort of a real biblical telling of this six-year-old who gets drunk, and there's some very, very funny sort of...
I really enjoyed that, though. That's probably a part of Shane that I wasn't aware of, was, and why would I be, of him growing up, like 6 years old, because you learn about how he became who he became with one of his aunts feeding him chocolate and alcohol and reading him the Bible, and he even said, I don't know if she was doing that to sort of get him into the Bible with all these treats of alcohol and chocolate, or it was just her way, smoking like a chimney at the age of five. So, you know, you could say it was child neglect to a point, if you want to go down that route, but it was different times, you know.
Well, I was going to say, we're talking sort of early 1960s in Ireland, which would have been where he holidayed, because obviously he was born.
Well, that's the thing. He grew up until I keep on saying growing up. He lived in Ireland until he was six, and then he moved to England.
Well, he
went to the summer holidays.
He was born in England. He then had lifetime over in Ireland as a child, which was very common back then, I believe. My partner's mum is like second generation Irish, and they would have their summers in Ireland, I believe. And you know, obviously living in Manchester now, a huge Irish community down in like sort of parts of where we're going to refer to shortly, which would have been like London Irish kind of communities. It was very much the thing to go home and be part of, like the kind of, I suppose, not luxury in the sense of you know, material things, but like,
look, get back to your roots.
They say that, you know, the sun set at 11 p.m. because of where obviously the west coast of Ireland faces out onto the and the kids would just play and be very, very sort of kind of like, you know, of the land and such. And they'd work, you know, at young ages on farms and fields and stuff. So there was this real kind of innocence, but then also this maturity that you get straight away. And I think that's probably something that a lot of English, Irish kind of like relationships with each country, if you were part of an Irish family born in England and you inheritively felt very Irish by your roots, by your 6, 7, 8, 9 weeks of the summer months being part of an Irish community, why you would struggle being back in England for all that time in a different education system. And I think that's what you see quite quickly, this rebellious streak. There's some, again, really, really good illustrations where McGowan's quickly bullied into become a bit of a bully, isn't he? A young school age before teenager, where he tweaks nipples and puts like nettles down like kids' underpants and stuff like that. And he's telling this great story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's... Yeah, it sounded quite medieval torture.
I think you see this character, this
his psyche,
rebel with a cause. Like, you know, it might have been a cause at school to be part of something more kind of belonging, because he says he didn't feel very English, and he didn't feel part of what England was. And I imagine a huge amount of Irish immigrants who came across to England, which there was a huge movement at this time. It probably tells a story for a lot of people, and not that long ago. You know, it's something that we see, you know, immigration over the world all the time, you know, now and for many, many, many centuries. But it's obviously one that's quite close to home when you're sort of in and around Irish families now, or second or third generation Irish families. So I kind of really warmed to him as this story got told.
Yeah.
Again, he tells a story of getting drunk for the first time, and his uncle found him pissed in the farmyard talking to the animals. Yeah. it's brilliant. And like I said, the illustrations are brilliant, and they are perfectly sort of pictating a story.
It helps the story move along. It is animation, but I mean, I like animation, to be fair, but it works with this story, because obviously there's no footage of what he was doing back then. I'm surprised actually when it gets to the 80s and the punk, or the late 70s, and gets to the punk movement.
There's so much footage of him.
How much footage is of him?
That was going to be
of him just messing about. And I was like, well, who could afford a camera?
I think you had a better understanding. So if we sort of slightly come away from his like childhood and stepping into this kind of punk scene, just before we go to that bit of the film, I think what's quite interesting is, all of a sudden, the film does take a shift, and you start seeing his sister talks a lot, and you get a lot of kind of a vox pop sort of head footage of her talking at the camera. But you get very little of him at this point, because I think it might have been quite difficult to sort of... You will realise as you carry on in the film that he's obviously at a stage of life where the alcohol and the drugs have definitely done him some
damage,
some time as such. Yeah, and he obviously finds it hard to sit up. He talks about it later on in the film as well. I think he said he'd like to just get his movement and stand up straight again. It's something as simple as that. But I think this footage, as maybe you and I would tell our youthful stories, it'd be us shot and interviewed as such, where you couldn't really tell it. You hear his voiceover. But then, like George says, all of a sudden it shifts this really colourful. So it goes from magenta, Irish, a lot of sort of stock footage, kind of. Even when you Google it and you look at the credits, a lot of the actors that are on the footage are accredited in this film, because it's stock footage from probably other bits of, you know, whatever footage was filmed at the time, which I thought was quite funny. But then all of a sudden you get this kind of, I didn't realise how punk he was within the scene. He's like a pin-up, isn't he?
Yeah,
he's like Mr.
Huge,
punk.
Poster boy of the punk movement.
Newsly, the all-in-one super app for iOS and Android. How does Newsly work, I hear you ask? Well, it picks up the most trending articles on the web on topics that you choose, and at any given moment reads them out in a natural human voice. For the first time ever, the entire web becomes listenable and all in one place. Browse articles from topics that you choose and start playing. Stop scrolling and start listening. You can follow topics such as sport, tech, business, science, or even music. They have a podcast as well. Explore trending podcasts from over 80 countries. Our podcast, the RBR.music podcast, is there too. I've started using it as my default podcast app, and they even have digital radio. So download and start using Newsly for free from www.newsly.me in the description. And if you use the promo code, that's RBRMUS, you'll receive 1 month free premium subscription. Go and give it a go.
He even says himself that he just always seemed to be in the right place at the right time, getting interviewed by all sorts of newspapers and magazines, more so than some of the bands. Maybe because, I mean, he's there at the front of the, right at the front where the bands are playing, and he's doing his pogo dancing. And I mean, let's not judge anyone by appearance, but he sticks out like a sore thumb, his appearance. So, you know.
Even in Punk, that's the thing that actually like got me, that like Punk was all about being
out there. Yeah.
You know, out there, an individual version of yourself, like choosing to kind of like go against mainstream. And there's Shane McGowan, and he looks even more against mainstream, and
he looks very at home. Yeah. I think he looks very at home. Well, he does
say that, and there are bits as well, actually, like because of the era, and I suppose anyone who's watched the TV series This Is England, and you can see a bit of like late 1970s England, like the Fred Perry polo shirts, and there's lots of like kind of like, you know, it's pre 80s kind of like. Men wearing makeup, but like a high volume of men starting to wear makeup. But he did. He dyed his hair. He talks about dyeing it blonde, wearing his mum's lipstick, and like there's this real kind of like
his mother's coat.
He finds himself, which I think, like you see that, and then you see the footage of him getting into fights with. He used to fight with like female mates and get bottled and
biting each
other. Yeah,
well, I think what interested me, like at the beginning of the documentary, there's a lot of disdain. Well, throughout the whole documentary, really, there's a lot of disdain for England's.
Yeah,
he doesn't like England's. Well, it's not so much he doesn't like it. Let's say he doesn't like it. He said he felt ashamed he didn't have the guts to join the IRA. So I presume he doesn't like England. Yeah. But when I was watching him in doing his pogo dancing in London in a Union Jack jacket, I thought, well, that's strange because you were in a Union Jack jacket. And then I was thinking, well, actually, maybe there's more to it than that because you've got Sid Vicious, he used to have this swastika emblem on his arms. And it's not saying he liked Nazis. He said he was repulsed by them. And it's to show that it's to get people thinking and annoyed and angry about the symbolism. And maybe that's why he wore that Union Jack jacket. And he said it couldn't be further from the truth when people were saying you're very pro-Britain wearing that jacket, and he just laughed it off. And that's bits where it kind of annoyed me in the documentary, because there was a lot of ins for him to open up, and he just never did. And I'm not sure if he did that on purpose, because he's like his punk attitude of you're not getting anything out of me. But it's a documentary about you, so please do tell us. But he does tell us a lot. Yeah, he does tell us.
I don't know if he warms to it for the filmmakers behind it, but like I mean chronologically, obviously the story we understand of him, there's clearly a storytelling pattern, and we do hear from him quite a lot. But I don't know how much hard work that was to get out. Maybe there was, you know, hours and hours of footage they had to work backwards on. However, a lot of this was, I think this was probably for me, the bit of the film that me and George talk about, kind of movies that you watch to have that classic roller coaster. You hit the high and then we almost want to turn the film off when it starts to slip down. You know, films that tell an outrageous, outlandish story, and then all of a sudden the hero of the film kind of like just loses everything, and he's like, I'll turn the film off, I don't want to watch that bit anymore. And I feel
I'm quite happy in a good mood, thank you.
And I don't mean to be disrespectful, because obviously Shane McGowan went on to lots of stuff after this, but this does feel like the very colourful part of Shane McGowan's life. It seems very like he's obviously learning himself, he's learning about his kind of like his alcohol intake, his drugs, his sexuality. He's kind of understanding everything about him. And I really liked that as he must have been 18, 20, 21, 19, you know, all around that sort of late teens, early 20s era for him. And I think there's an element of like rebellious youth that we all like to see a story of. You see him and his relationship with, is it Shayna Bradley? The co founder of the Nipple Erectors,
that's punk for you.
But they're standing outside, is it Buckingham Palace, with a sheep on a lead, and They take their sheep on holiday with their with his parents, and his parents are obviously so in awe in him becoming who he is. I think normally
they seem very extremely liberal.
Yeah, well, I think you'd have to be.
And you find out how liberal they are as the documentary goes on. With he's allowed to bring all his friends just to doss over at the flat. But that was in the Barbican, which is just an absolute concrete jungle. And they talk about his mother having a mental breakdown. So then his mother goes to an asylum or a secure unit for a little bit to get better. Although he says she never really got better. They just dosed her full of drugs. But yeah, that's another insight into his life I was unaware of how... I mean, if I was watching this in my teens, I'd be like, how cool is this? But when I'm watching it now, I just feel he needed guidance and he wasn't getting it. And it was very unhinged, his upbringing, by the looks of it. Like, he was taking acid with his mate and a girl in his parents' apartment. And she wanted to throw herself off the balcony in the Barbican. And
the dad's fuming because he's been woken up.
Yeah, the dad's fuming saying, the dad's fuming because he's been woken up. And it's like, well, there's a girl that wants to throw herself off. It just seems, I don't know. And the dad's all the way through it seems to dislike his son. Because he openly says at 12... When he hit the age of 12, that's when I lost him.
I think I got the sort of dislike that you're referring to, but I think I think there's more a kind of... I got the impression that the father wouldn't be embarrassed by his son's behaviour, so the only way he could not be embarrassed was just like...
Because the dad's anti-establishment
and
so he's quite happy to see his son be
exactly, and he's anti-English, and there's this collective movement which is very understood as time, and I think that's where Julian Temple has, like, I think it's the skill of storytelling, because the way you've just described it, and hopefully it came across to the listeners, that you were emotionally drawn into kind of a juxtaposition of feeling, if I was 17, 18, 19, I'd be like, oh, you know, bloody hell, that's like fucking cool or whatever, so cool. and then all of a sudden actually being 39 like we are now, going, well, obviously it's not, like, you know, there's fucking stupidity here, and if someone jumped off the 15th floor of a building, they're gonna die, and then all of a sudden you've got a story of woe. And I do think the storytelling of the documentary is really good to this point, and I think it's from this point you start to see the honesty that maybe you don't get as much in later on in the documentary or later age of Shane McGowan, but there's a real honesty at this point from Shane McGowan, because he almost, he didn't really know what to do with himself, and he's looking at everything, and the world is changing around him. Punk is disappearing.
The new romantic scene is coming in.
Synth was coming in. He just wasn't, he'd lost his little bit of the world that he found comfortable. And I really like the point, because I didn't know this about the Pogues, that he created the Pogues based on the fact that there was world music elsewhere. So if you weren't into synth or new romantics for him in his part of the world there and then, the other choice was you could listen to world music all around London, of course, huge population of people from everywhere. And he...
Like reggae and stuff.
Yeah, and he says, why do I need to, like, listen to music from other people's heritage? I'm going to bring the music from my heritage. And as much as I think you and I both agree we're not the biggest Pogue fans by any means, like, I think that's really quite a cool way of creating a modern take of a folk Irish kind of, you know, pipe whistle and flute and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's quite a cool way to approach it. It might not be what we're going to put on.
I love the facts that when he says, I was waiting for someone else to do it, but no one was doing it, so I decided to do it. And it's like, everything just seemed to fall really into... Well, that's the thing with this documentary. It does appear that everything just fell into his lap, just by accident. So you don't really see how much he had to work for it. Later on in the documentary, you see how the touring schedule absolutely destroys him. But before that, everything just falls into place for him. Like, I wanted to be in bands that did sort of modernised Irish folk songs. And then all of a sudden he's in the Pogues and he's doing really well.
Well, I think what's nice as well, you see this honesty that refer to as you're understanding the journey of the Pogues, which is clearly a love for music and anarchy, but then also, and we'll come back to this in a moment, like the poetry that he clearly has a talent of writing, the lyricist that he clearly was, the writer, the musician. However, you continuously see this honesty that I don't think at that time, mid-70s, that television or radio were used to. So he's on, is it Danny Baker? It's one of the kind of...
Danny Baker.
He's almost calling Shane McGowan. It's like, it's quite provocative, the interview style. And I think you probably watched...
Especially for nowadays, it's actually quite intrusive. Nowadays, they just have a joke and... talk about absolutely nothing. This is very
He's never phased.
Interrogating.
He's never phased at this point.
No.
And I kind of warmed to him again at this point. And I was like, actually, do you know what? Fair enough. You've not gone and got offended. There's a few bits where he puffs out his cheek and he's like, here we go again. I've got to answer this. And there's even a bit of a mockery of the amount of times he gets asked about his drugs and his boozing and all that kind of stuff. And I think he's probably bored of it because I think simply when it comes down to the alcohol and the drugs, he basically just likes being pissed. That's how he puts it, right?
Yeah, his body needs it now. But I think he's just happy. The thing is, I think he became a caricature of himself when he started producing crap songs by the Pogues later on in the Pogues' career. And now he's not even a caricature of himself. He's just, as the documentary goes on, well, throughout the documentary, really, there's cutaways of him sort of nodding off in a bar, at home and stuff. And then the next minute, you know, is saying how much he loves drinking and he loves life. And I say nodding off, but I mean, as in, his body's just stops functioning. It's weird. You have to watch it to understand. Like, he's just like almost keeling over. And then in the next breath he's saying, I love alcohol, I love my life. And it's like, it doesn't all add, like the way it's cut just seems to not work for how he wants to portray himself.
Is that not the story of someone who has clearly
done it?
I don't
all.
Know if he referred. Yeah. To, well,
it's
no,
like
no.
Been a
I mean more. Well, no more. Like the fact that it is like if someone is continuously on like drugs and alcohol, they're going to be an up and down person because that's what alcohol and drugs do to you. They take you to one extreme, the other, and I almost felt like the documentary...
So they were capturing that on purpose
not.
Of his mood swings.
Maybe. I mean, I
suppose everything's on camera on purpose, isn't it?
Well, we don't talk about this, but Jordan and I, we did documentary making at university. Clearly did not have careers in documentary making. But
I told you it would come in handy. Look at us now, Ma. Talking about other people's work, yep.
But the one thing we were always taught is, you know, everything is captured, but everything is manipulated. Like, no documentary is true to storytelling unless you just leave the film, the camera running, and then you watch 8 hours of raw footage. So, for me, I think...
Which isn't going to be overly engrossing for the viewer.
Not at all, no. So, for me, I think that the way it is kind of slightly disjointed maybe is a bit of a metaphor for kind of the way people, and I'm not talking about Shane here, anyone... on drugs and alcohol, you're up and down, you blow your high, all that kind of stuff. Mm. I mean, it's really quite sad, actually, because after you understand this of him, he then turns around and says, like, he only stayed in the Pogues because they needed him, because if he left, he felt that the Pogues would go, and he felt the pressure to be the continual.
Well, his sister said she addressed the band and said he wants to leave, and they got really annoyed with her.
Well, he tried to quit. Didn't
he was the cash cow. Yeah, he tried to quit, and he wouldn't have it. And he's like 360 odd.
Yeah, 363 days on the trot, like a whole year gigging.
And then he said, even then you're going through the motions, so you're not being true to yourself and you're not being true to the audience. And by and large, being true to himself is everything. Well, it's for everybody. You've got to be true to yourself, or else, you know, you're just living in a fantasy world.
No, absolutely. And then I think the film starts to come to a storytelling end with Shane McGowan, I think now is 63. Three now, but I think the time of storytelling is about, I think he turned 60, doesn't he? So he has a 60th birthday party, which is which is where you have this kind of slight, I don't know, I didn't realise he was not, I've always known he's well thought of, I don't mean that, but like, he seems to have a lot of, celebrity is the wrong word, but successful people around him that clearly appreciate what he has done and is doing.
People idolise him, absolutely idolise him.
But people you just wouldn't expect. I mean, we were talking about it before. For his 60th birthday, there's a live performance of his songs by, you know, lesser-known musicians, but also very well-known musicians. I think the footage starts with Bono, obviously music and Irish connection. Then you see people like Carl Barrett on stage from the Libertines, Johnny Depp's playing guitar in the background. Obviously, we've mentioned he's a producer of the film as well. Yeah. And then probably the biggest name of the music scene, your man, Judd.
Yeah, Nick Cave.
Nick Cave.
My man. But I was thinking that's slightly odd. But then not really, because I think Nick Cave's taken a lot of Shane's workings and put it into his own lyrics, because they're both very morbid and poetic in their imagery. And I think Nick Cave was overwhelmed with love and just honour of being on the same stage as him. You can see it in his eyes, he's welling up, that he's sharing the stage with him. And I thought that was a lovely moment.
Well, considering it's Nick Cave, you know, a huge musician for a number of sort of decades and generations for people. And I was a bit taken aback by that. I was like, that's pretty massive. I think, though, it's probably best at this point that we've kind of told the story of the documentary. But the simple reality is, when you're listening and trying to understand who Shane McGowan is, like, and he almost regretfully says, he is this sort of perfect poet, right, George? He's someone who can write these fantastic lyrics. And I mentioned the fact that, and I'm probably teaching everyone to suck eggs here, that he's such the poet that he is it's referenced a little bit very often throughout the whole film, certainly middle to back end of the film. But it's almost like there's an element of acceptance and enjoyment from him, but also he says a line, it's a bit annoying because how have I just wasted my poetry by writing songs, which I thought was a really nice way to look at things, something that we've all enjoyed. And there's a huge focus on Fairy Tale of New York, obviously the Pogues' biggest song. And actually, there's a really nice fact, isn't there, in the film, George, where it's the highest-selling Christmas song of all time.
Going back to his poetry, I do fully understand what he means by as he wasted his time just writing songs. But I don't think he has, because for artists like Shane McGowan, like Bob Dylan, like Nick Cave, like true artists of music, this is the new medium for poetry. Like, poetry has such an albatross around its neck of bad sort of... You're just going to fall asleep. If someone goes, oh, do you want to read this poetry book? It's like, well, no, I don't. Thank you very much. I've got better things to do in my time. But it, a lot of poetry can be very rich and insightful and, you know... But the masses genuinely don't steer towards poetry. They steer towards music. And I think this is... I say new. I mean, it's music's obviously been around since forever. But Bob Dylan changed the way a song could be delivered and written. And Shane McGowan is exactly the same. He's in the same company as the greats. You touched on it before. We're not overly enamoured by the Pogues. I appreciate the Pogues. I appreciate the punk movement. Something needed to be done. There's all. I'm glad it happens. It's not my sort of thing, but to read his poetry, to listen to him, I've like Nirvana. I don't really like Nirvana, but I've got a lot of time for Kurt Cobain. I mean, I like some Nirvana songs, obviously, but I've got a lot of time when Kurt Cobain gets interviewed. I find him an interesting, articulate person. The same with Shane McGowan. Once you get past the drawl, and
but I think that's the interesting thing, because me and Jordan were talking before we started recording, and it's funny, you know, Jordan's a massive Bob Dylan fan, and I've always known Jordan from a young age, fell in love with lyrics, possibly over music first. Like, I could tell. Jordan would, like, he'd quote lyrics back at me and be like, how good's that lyric? How good's this? And there's always, you have a different level of sort of...
I wanted to get to understand where the artist was coming from. Now, as time's progressed, I've got into music and the artist can speak through the instrument. I understand that now. But, yeah, lyrics for me are a huge deal. I mean, I also like poetry. But I think if this documentary gives us anything, it's how genius Shane McGowan is with creating wonderful pieces of poetry, of lyrics. They are mesmerisingly good. And I hope people who watch this see through the state of him, is keeled over, still clutching his alcohol, his nicotine-stained fingers. He has a brain in there. He is just this wonderful, articulate person.
Yeah, and he's sadly, I can only assume, there doesn't seem to be any factual information on this, but the booze and the alcohol and the drugs have just brought him to an early sort of crescendo of like almost being, because there's one bit where...
Well, that's the thing. It's for me, I was quite a heavy drinker and when I was younger, and there's obviously, I'm not a rock star or whatever, but it becomes a bit, if you're going to bring it into middle age, it gets a bit cringy, like, oh, behave yourself. And that's where Shane McGowan is falling into slightly, where it's a bit, oh, bloody hell.
But that's, I think that's where you, if, and I'm no doctor, I have no knowledge in this, but like, that's surely we've got to say that, like, there's a dependency, there's a...
yeah, there is a dependency, definitely. He's dependent on alcohol.
I wouldn't want to call anyone an alcoholic
and I wouldn't want to tell anyone how to live their lives. He's fairly happy with his lot, but you don't know if that's a pretense, because you know, people with addictions do pretend they're all right.
I think you can sense a bit of that. There's some slightly awkward footage with Johnny Depp and him, clearly both quite drunk, seem to be necking whiskey, and it almost feels like it's fine to do. It's there's no judgment here of it being done. Most of us have all sat there and got too drunk. I think the only thing is, it seems to be a way of being for Shane, and that's like, hey, everyone to their own. But the guy's in his early 60s, and he just seems like he's running out of being to continue, which is such a shame when clearly there's a lot of talent in this man, and you feel that, and you almost finish the film going, oh, I wish I'd been around at the time, but I wasn't, but maybe I wish I could hear more of what doesn't yet exist, and maybe we never will, but maybe we will, who knows.
He does say that right at the end, he wants to, if he could do anything now, it would be do more writing songs and playing pool, because he can't stand up.
Yeah, which is quite a nice but sad ending. And I've got to say, I think overall, I do think the way Julian Temple has put this together, I think there are a few confusing parts of the film in storytelling sort of motif, but fundamentally there is a clear start, middle and end. There is a great telling of Shane's life. You get enough of his cheeky kind of like, his cheeky way of being, because he is quite cheeky, he's quite naughty, you can hear it, you can see it in him. He's like a naughty school kid a lot of the time. His laugh, when I first heard his sort of sniggering, kind of quite scary laugh, actually, you realise...
It's been there,
the laugh has been there and done that. The laugh's there in the footage from his sort of late teens, early 20s, or when he's on television. Like, you can hear this absolute, like, cheeky being. And I think I took from the film the most that there's a talent there, unbelievable talent. There's a person, there's a character. There's a man who loves... I mean, he talks about his first proper girlfriend, and he says she was, like, one of the loveliest people he'd ever met. He's now married to his long-term partner, and he's, you know, he winds her up a bit. He sort of even pokes fun at her, and she's clearly in a very good state of living. She's a very good-looking woman, a couple of years younger than him. But, like, he sort of admits that he was never perfect. He was never the handsome guy, but he knew what to do. And it's almost like he's still doing it now. He's working with the cards that either he was dealt or he dealt himself. Does that make sense?
But listening to him speak, once you tune your ear into how he speaks, you actually want him to come back. When you see the other talking heads, like, talking about him, you're like, oh, I want Shane to talk a bit more. When he's talking about the fighting in Ireland and stuff, he knows, he's well-read. He knows a great deal of the history of Ireland. And I found him a really interesting guy. My only issue with the documentary, but Bobby Gillespie of Primal Scream, talking to him, didn't get anything out of him. Who was that politician? Jerry Adams.
I feel that's a continuing...
Do you think that's meant?
Subgenre of... Going back to our uni days, I think it's there for a reason. I'm not saying it's staged or forced. I just think it's a clear exposure.
Who the man is.
The opening scene does it, and then you get it. You must get it five or six, maybe seven times.
I just thought it was a bit jarring.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I'm going along with the flow of the movie, and I'm following it, and then all of a sudden we're in a bar, but like, there's no one else in the bar, maybe because Johnny Depp's such a famous guy or whatever. All the curtains are drawn, it's just sad, gloomy. It's like Last Orders, it's like they've already had a skin.
But I feel that's a metaphor of maybe where Shane McGowan is in his life now, because you don't hit
Last orders.
You don't hear the Pogues. You don't hear from the Pogues when he spent, you know, many, many, many days, 363 on the trot with the Pogues. You don't see him with a collective of people except his 60th birthday. There is no...
You don't see any what's it called, management. You don't see any music magazines, sort of editors talking about how big he was and how popular he was. Which is fair enough. It's like a lot of people have deserted him, and he's just sat in a bar by himself.
Have they deserted him, or has he deserted them? I wouldn't know, or haven't have enough knowledge to say. But I mean, even Anne Scanlon, who is the Pogue's biographer, like she gets a handful of words.
10 minutes.
I mean, you see a lot from Victoria, his wife, and I think his mum and dad get a fair amount of airtime in the sense of the storytelling. But you almost get the same volume from Gerry Adams, like you said. It's his sister definitely has the highest volume of storytelling to camera.
But the thing is with Gerry Adams, I probably have to watch it again, but I felt like he was putting words in Shane's mouth, and Shane was just going, yeah, yeah.
And but again,
that sounded dodgy, didn't it? But Shane's just agreeing with him, and there's the odd sort of sentence where he seems like he's going somewhere with it. But yeah, I understand why Gerry Adams has to be there. I understand that. But maybe it's like he's rubbed shoulders with the hierarchy, like, you know, of politicians.
Well, I mean, I personally, and I've only just really clicked this while you're talking then, I personally think that it's almost these bodies around him, be it the Johnny Depp, Gerry Adams, they're almost propping him metaphorically up for some kind of conversation to get it out of him. Because even if you look at the TV footage from, I'm guessing, around the sort of, you know, mid-80s, whatever.
It's hard to interview.
It's hard to interview then. So why wouldn't it be harder 30 years on in life, knackered, tired and a bit pissed off? Because that's basically how it seems to me that he...
But I also think for a two-hour documentary or over two-hour documentary, if that's the best, how awkward must he be to interview if that's the best that they can come up with into the final piece of work? There is a few laughs when he talks about painting himself blue and that sort of thing.
But he tells stories as if you're sat at a table in an Irish pub talking about a life experience. And I think that's where you've got...
Only for that, though. Most of it is him telling people to fuck off. Stop interrogating me, he says. It's like, well, we're here to learn about you.
Well, that's where Julian Temple and the team that he worked with, I think they've done really well to create a 2-hour and 4-minute documentary with a protagonist who clearly didn't want
to.
Very
awkward.
I'm not sure he even wanted to have the documentary done, because I can honestly say, pieces to camera, there's less than 20 minutes of Shane McGowan talking to camera. And
yeah, but there's a lot of voiceover.
But that's different, isn't it? I'm not saying voiceovers. I'm talking about like pieces to camera. We're watching a visual medium here, so for me, it's a real challenge to put all that audio to a visual for 2 hours. And I think they've done really well.
But don't you think that if it's just him, I suppose you could. Yeah, I was going to say it would be a bit boring if it was just him talking to camera, but I guess they would do it a different way. And they did do it a different way. But you don't really... He's not very mobile. I don't know how else you would do this documentary, because he's clearly unwell. Unwell throughout his whole life, so maybe he's doing all right for himself.
And I think that's the artistic point. I think, you know, the story's been told with the challenges that clearly were there to tell it. And again, you don't want to not show Shane McGowan. And like any of us, as we all age, we probably look back at the yesteryear when we looked a bit younger and, you know, sort of fresher faced and everything else. And actually, Shane McGowan is this very, very, very tired 60-year-old who has pretty much drank and, you know, taken everything under the sun to, you know, to a position of he's quite a feeble, weak, physically person, not mentally. I think that's still sharp, but you can see he's slumped in his chair, and arguably there's bits of the film that you do feel a bit uncomfortable watching him, because he doesn't look comfortable. He's slumped, he's leant over to one side,
and his eyes look like swollen. And
well, at this point as well,
alcoholism, so
jaundice. For anyone who doesn't know, he was famed for his quite terrible teeth, as a lot of Brits were. For any Americans, I know that's always the joke, but like he had terrible teeth through his 20s and whatnot.
I thought he looked all right. You should see the state of mine. No, yeah, he did have terrible teeth.
But he's had his teeth done, and actually, it's funny because in his older age, he's sort of slightly, very worn down physical presence.
Perfect teeth.
His new teeth actually changed the way he looks, and I found that quite hard, actually, when you were going back from footage, because he has this real look to him, and obviously having different shaped teeth changes the shape of your mouth and your face. So I don't know. There's a little bit. I always think Johnny Cash and forget the actor's name, Marlon Brando, they both said they hated the way they looked as they became older and, you know, like more weighty men, because they were these good looking striking men. And I reckon everyone has a little bit of that in them anyway. Maybe Shane McGowan the littlest of all, but like, did he want to be on camera? Maybe he didn't, and that's why there's so much audio, because there isn't a lot of modern footage of him. And yeah, that's a funny one, because when you're telling a story, either you're telling a biopic as such, where you're just kind of telling the story of someone, or that person is telling a story, and this is obviously the latter, and you're not really seeing a huge amount of him. But hey, I don't know, I'm speculating, I'm just trying to kind of understand the film like anyone should do. However, I think you can all tell, listeners, we have both enjoyed watching this film, and it's something that we thought we'd give it a go. Obviously, it's music related, a very, very well-known and loved artist. And as with any of our reviews, we have the rbr.music star rating. Jordan.
We certainly do. Okay, if you're a fan of Shane McGowan and the Pogues, or just Shane McGowan, I really don't think this is anything new to you. For a newcomer to Shane McGowan and the Pogues, it'll be a whirlwind of interest, I suppose. But I've grown up with the Pogues. Not with the Pogues music, just with Tall Tales from my dad's. Like, my dad's dad was Irish, and my uncles, they have Tall Tales. So I knew more about Shane McGowan than I probably did about the Pogues. It is called Crock of Gold, A Few Rounds with Shane McGowan. So I should have been aware that there wasn't going to be anything overly new throwing up at me. The first part of the documentary I found really interesting, about his young life, and what shaped him to being the man. And you look back and say, was that child neglect and that sort of thing? But also, it sounds like not a fairy tale, but sort of a Brothers Grimm tale, where all these strange goings-ons happening. There's men giving him whiskey and God knows what. Even points out that he was a rent boy doing hand jobs as well. Not when he was a child, let me just get that clear, when he was living in London. So that, I found that interesting, that he was open about talking about that. But by and large, nothing overly grabbed me. I liked the style of the documentary. I liked the use of the animation. I don't think there was enough talking heads of different people. Like, they didn't interview the Pogues, they didn't interview the Popes, which is his other band. They didn't interview any music magazine editors, or Danny Baker, who was interviewing him. Danny Baker must have said it was all right to use his face on there. So I'm going to give it a strong 3.5 out of 5.
Well, there you go. That's our first star rating for a music doco.
Does that annoy you, Steve? Or would you give it higher or lower?
No, I think I think you're probably about right. I warmed to the film after a little while. I found some things a little bit harder and long in the tooth to watch. I found some things really interesting, and I think, yeah, I think a strong 3.5 is about right. Again, we've not given one before, so we don't know. And we don't want to go down the route of reviewing kind of films that lots of people have seen, because both Jordan and I, we mentioned we did documentary at university, and we have watched some brilliant music documentaries. We are trying to find the slightly untold stories and kind of hopefully get a bit more out there. I think this is definitely an untold story that if you're a fan, you know. If you're not a fan, like me, I learned quite a lot, and I enjoyed the journey of learning. I think they've done really well to make the documentary out of what they had. It's a bit too long. I think 2 hours it didn't need to be.
It didn't need to be 2 hours.
No, 90 minutes is probably about right, maximum, I would say. But it is lively. It's got some great musical interludes. It's got some really good storytelling. We didn't touch on it massively, but if anyone does know the Pogues, they will know Fairy Tale of New York. And there's a really, really nice piece on that. And there's a nice little dedication in there. So there is some really nice pieces. So for me, I can't disagree at all. 3.5 Jord, spot on. So for the first music doco, star rating, 3.5 out of 5. Well, nice one, guys, for listening. We've enjoyed giving this one a go. Please do like, subscribe, and plug into any of the podcast or Instagram platforms that we have available for you. You will be able to find more reviews and more musical reviews, and hopefully more film music docker reviews in the future. We always get some great comments and conversation from people, and I know Jordan has already received a number of documentaries that people would like us to watch and give a go. So that is a journey that we're going to step into. Be it we publish and release some of those, we do not know. So again, thanks for listening, guys, and we look forward to talking at you again soon. Cheers.